We're ready to begin, so if you would, please begin to take your seat. Can you hear me now? That's much better. Much better. I want to welcome everyone here tonight. We're glad to be here again on this third night of this four-night debate. Again, for those who may not know who I am, my name is John Moore, and I work with the University Church of Christ here in San Marcos. Also work with the student organization known as the McCarty Student Center that is registered with Southwest Texas State University. And we're glad to be sponsoring this debate. We're glad that you're here and able to hear the remarks and the arguments and discussion that will proceed tonight. Before we begin, though, let us say a few words as in way of preliminary remarks that need to be made. And we do want to let you know, first of all, what the proposition is. And the proposition for tonight stands as the following: that the alleged moral atrocities ascribed to the God of the Bible are actual moral atrocities and therefore constitute proof that the Bible is not inspired of God. Affirming this proposition tonight will be Mr. Farrell Till of Canton, Illinois. Mr. Till holds the bachelor and master's degrees from Harding University. Mr. Till is a former preacher for Churches of Christ, where Mr. Till worked among various congregations until 1963. And then in 1965, he became an instructor of English at the Spoon River College in Canton, Illinois. He's also currently engaged in public and written debates on the topic that will be discussed tonight. He's also publisher and editor of a quarterly journal known as the Skeptical Review. And denying the proposition tonight will be Mr. Mac Deaver. Mr. Deaver holds the bachelor's and master's degrees from Harding University, and he's a former preacher, or he is a preacher for Churches of Christ, and is editor, co-editor of Biblical Notes, and does various preaching at lectureships and meetings and debates as well. So tonight we're very happy to have these two men here to debate this very, very important subject. Prior to the debate, the two men wrote one another and decided upon a few basic rules for the debate, and I would like to read those tonight. Each speaker, when in the affirmative, is to be careful to state the issue clearly and to define the terms of his proposition. Each speaker is to consider the other equal and is not to employ arrogant language, is to be careful to stay on the subject, is to try to avoid the use of ambiguous language, is to cast no personal reflections, is to seek to avoid eliciting demonstrations from the audience, is to answer arguments, is to be careful to avoid questioning motives. Each speaker may show the consequence of a doctrine or position, but must not charge the other with believing that consequence unless the other actually does believe it. Each speaker must examine the evidence with fairness. Each speaker must not ridicule, must treat the other in harmony with the principles of Christian attitude and conduct. And then something else that needs to be made note of, that no new material will be presented in the final negative of each disputant. And according to these rules, each disputant may state the issue, define the terms, illustrate points, argue the case, and call for evidence. And then each disputant has decided, agreeing to abide by each of these or each one of the rules that is listed. Now, the format for the debate tonight and for tomorrow night as well will be the following. The speakers will arrive approximately at 6:30 and will exchange questions. Those questions will be dealt with during the course of the evening. And then at approximately 7 o'clock, we will begin the debate with the first affirmative speech lasting 30 minutes, followed by a negative speech lasting 30 minutes, and then we'll have a short break, and then there will be a second affirmative speech lasting 20 minutes, followed by a second negative speech lasting 25 minutes, and then the affirmative will have a 5-minute rejoinder, and then the debate will end for the evening. Now, before we begin, let me say a few remarks concerning your responsibility as an audience. As we've said in the previous nights, and we want to again reiterate how important it is that you have a responsibility in this debate. And part of your responsibility in this debate is to weigh the evidence that is presented, to listen very carefully to what each man is saying, and decide for yourself the truth on these matters. We also want you to realize that we must only accept those conclusions that are warranted by evidence. We must also ask that each member of the audience conduct his or herself in a very peaceful manner, that you not display any emotions as far as your feelings that indicate your feelings toward the debater or toward the arguments that are being presented. And so accordingly, we ask that you not make any noises or have any verbal or nonverbal expressions to the best of your ability that would indicate your feelings toward this. We also ask that you let the debaters do the debating. And so please do not discuss the issues related to this topic tonight on the debate site, especially at the break, and we ask that you please abide by that. And be it known also that if you become disruptive in any way or cause a problem, that you would be asked to leave. And then our aim also, as we want to point out, and our desire is that both sides of this issue be clearly heard and understood, and that we conduct this debate in a very organized, systematic, and a very orderly fashion. And so, without any further comments, let me say once again, as we define the proposition, or state the proposition, as the following: that the alleged moral atrocities ascribed to the God of the Bible are actual moral atrocities, and therefore constitute proof that the Bible is not inspired of God. And affirming this proposition tonight will be Mr. Till, and denying will be Mr. Deaver.
I assume everybody understands by now that I'm happy to be here. And since time passes quickly, I'm going to dispense with preliminaries and get right to the matter at hand tonight. The proposition was just read, so I won't read it again. But in effect, I'm affirming the opposite of what Mr. Deaver affirmed Monday night and Tuesday night. But so that there won't be any doubt about what the issue is, I am going to take a moment to define the key terms of the proposition, although essentially I did agree with the definition that he gave to those terms. By allege, I mean to assert to be true without proof. I possibly have a slightly different slant to this word. The Bible alleges that certain events took place. I'm not at all sure that they did actually take place. I'm pretty sure that they didn't take place exactly as was alleged. But I'm saying that if they did occur, and if they did occur exactly as they are recorded in the Bible, then they constitute sufficient grounds for us to reject the doctrine of divine inspiration. The word moral means that which is concerned with the discernment of what is good or evil. We've talked a lot about that the first two nights. I believe that it's possible for one to use his intelligence to discern the difference between good and evil. Atrocities are those things that are extremely evil, savage, or cruel. And again, I think it's quite easy for one to use his intelligence to determine what is savage and what is cruel. If I saw a dog on the street, although that dog is not human, if I deliberately in some way tortured that animal, I would say that would be a cruel thing to do, therefore it would be an immoral thing to do. And we're going to talk about cruelty that was done by human beings in the name of the God of the Bible. Ascribe means to attribute to a specific cause or source. As we're going to notice, many of these events that I call atrocities were ascribed to the God of the Bible. He was supposed to be the source of them, in that he either did them himself or that he authorized others to do them. By actual, I mean real, existing in fact, not imaginary. If these did happen, as they are recorded in the Bible, then I'm affirming that they constitute actual atrocities, real atrocities, that they're just not something that exists in the imagination. Constitute means to establish, to consist as. Proof means evidence sufficient to establish truth. I'm going to be affirming that if these events happened exactly as they are recorded in the Bible, then that is sufficient proof or evidence to establish my belief that the Bible could not have been inspired of God. By the term Bible, I mean exactly what he meant when he defined it, the 66 books in this book that's on the pulpit in front of me. It is the book that's recognized by Christians, members of the Church of Christ, as you please, to be God's revealed word. Mr. Deaver defined inspired to mean God breathed. I will accept that. The word inspired means to elicit or to create in another. Those who believe in the inspiration of the Bible believe that God in some miraculous way elicited the very words that the writers of the Bible used so that they would be certain to record the exact truth that he wanted to be recorded. Now, Mr. Deaver and I possibly differ on the definition of the word God. He means Yahweh of the Hebrews, Jehovah, if you please. I don't mean that. I can accept the fact that if Yahweh of the Hebrews existed, that he could inspire a book like this, because that would be just like him, wouldn't it? You know, what many people don't understand is that when Christianity started, it wasn't the wonderfully unified thing that many people think that it was. It was divided into various sects. One of those sects was the Gnostic sect, which was the primary opponent of the Pauline brand of Christianity. Now, most of you people believe in the Pauline brand of Christianity. The winds of circumstance and chance just happened to blow in the right direction so that this was the one that triumphed, and Gnosticism was forgotten. But many of the Gnostics believed that the Old Testament scriptures were written, they were inspired by Yahweh of the Hebrews. And they believed this because there were so many things in it, like the things that I'm going to be talking about, that they just could not accept the fact that an infinitely good God could have possibly inspired that. So when I'm talking about God, I am talking about the concept of a God who is omnibenevolent and infinitely good. I'm affirming, in other words, that if the events that I call atrocities actually occurred as they are recorded in the Bible, it is not possible that the Bible was verbally inspired by an omnibenevolent deity. Now, I've used the term Yahweh, and so I want to talk about that for a moment before I go on. Yahweh is the name by which the Hebrews designated their tribal God. Now, Mr. Deaver might not like it that I'm calling him a tribal god. But if you'll study the history of the time, you'll find that the Hebrews were really no different from the nations around them. The Moabites believed in their tribal god Chemosh. The Philistines believed in their tribal god Dagon, and so on. The Hebrews simply believed in their tribal god Yahweh. In early translations of the Bible, that name was rendered Jehovah. But since those translations were completed, Bible scholars are pretty well in agreement that that was not the way that the Hebrews actually pronounced the name, that Yahweh comes closer to approximating the pronunciation. So I'm going to be using that term, and even when I read from the scriptures, I'm going to substitute quite often the name Yahweh or Jehovah, or the Lord, as it's rendered in the King James translation. So I hope that you will understand that. Now, I'm going to have to resist the temptation to reply to the volley of arguments that Mr. Deaver fired at me last night. If you were in attendance, you know what I'm talking about. The transparencies on the overhead projector were going by so rapidly that we couldn't even read what was on the transparencies. This morning, I sat down and I read the copies that were given to me. It took me 11 minutes just to read them. Of course, I read them slowly because I wanted to absorb the thought in the line of his reasoning, but I hope you can understand from that the reason why it wasn't possible for me last night to take the time to try to reply to those arguments. Quite frankly, I didn't even know what some of them said because I had not had the time to read them. And so I'm sorely tempted tonight to take the time to reply to some of those, especially the one about predictive prophecy, though I'd love to talk about predictive prophecies. And I'm going to tell him this. If he'd like to debate that proposition, it'd be possible for us to arrange something. I'd like nothing better than to affirm or to debate a proposition like that. And I don't know, maybe he had that in mind when he fired that volley of arguments last night, that he thought maybe I would begin tonight by talking about those instead of the things that I am going to talk about, because it's very obvious that he does not want to talk about the issue of moral atrocities as they seem to have occurred in the Bible. But I hate to disappoint him. I'm in the affirmative tonight. And so I'm the one that will be setting the agenda. And I am going to concentrate on some of those things that I tried to get him to talk about Monday night and Tuesday night. Now, it was said that we're going to be gentlemanly during the debate, and that we've agreed to do that, and that we're not going to use arrogant language, and every time that's read, my wife looks at me and gives me that look as if to say, now you keep that in mind. I was going to say, I am going to nail his hide to the wall tonight, but I'm going to take that back, and I'm going to state it like this. I'm going to try to nail his hide to the wall, because I think I have plenty of nails to do that with. But I hope you understand that when I do that, I am attacking what he believes, and I'm not attacking him personally. I'll tell you, quite frankly, I have found him to be a very friendly and likable individual. It's just too bad that he hasn't seen certain truths that I hope eventually he will come to see. So if I seem to be a little aggressive tonight, I hope you'll understand that I am not trying to attack him personally. I am attacking what he stands for. And I'm going to begin with something that I introduced last night, but I noticed that when he came back to make his second speech, he didn't even mention it. He talked about how it was all right for God to terminate somebody. Well, you know, that sounds like some of the language that might come out of the Pentagon when they talk about a very destructive weapon and they call it an anti-personnel device, when actually the thing exists for the sole purpose of doing mass destruction. God has the right to terminate somebody. He indicated that he didn't like the word murder. And so I'm going to try to accommodate him tonight. I am not going to use the word murder. I'm going to say killed deliberately. When the Bible tells us that God slew so-and-so, I trust he will agree that that meant that God deliberately killed him. It couldn't be, could it, that God accidentally killed him? Because that would imply that God was capable of making an error. And his concept of God will not allow that. So I'm going to try to refrain from using the word murder tonight. And I'm going to talk about killing someone deliberately. Now, he believes, apparently, that if God deliberately kills someone, that that's okay. And last night I mentioned that interesting little story that you read in the 38th chapter of Genesis. And I'm going to bring it up again tonight because he didn't mention it. If you recall, this is where we have the account of Judah, one of the 12 sons of Jacob, who married a woman by the name of Tamar. Rather, he married and he had three sons. One was named Ur, and one was named Onan, and the other was named Shelah. Believe it or not, Shelah was a man's name. Ur married a woman named Tamar, and he did that which was wicked in the sight of Yahweh, and so Yahweh slew him. Yahweh killed him deliberately, in other words. Now, we don't know what Ur did, but he did something that was wicked in the sight of Yahweh, and so Yahweh killed him deliberately. According to the custom then, it was necessary for Onan, the second son, to go into Tamar, his brother's widow, and try to impregnate her so that she would give birth to a son who would legally be considered the son of his dead brother. The ninth verse tells us that Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. I assume he had enough sense to know that biologically it would be his, but he knew that legally it would not be his. So it tells us that he spilled his seed on the ground. We're talking about coitus interruptus, if I may speak as delicately as possible about this. This simply means that right at the moment of climax, or before the moment of climax, he withdrew from Tamar so that his semen was spilled on the ground so that there would not be a chance that she would be impregnated. Verse 10 says, "And the thing which he did was evil in the sight of Yahweh, and he slew him also." So now we know what Onan did that caused Yahweh to kill him deliberately. He was guilty of the act of coitus interruptus. I want you to consider that passage in the context of something that's written in Deuteronomy, the 25th chapter, beginning with verse 5. If you would, follow along with me. "If brethren dwell together and one of them die and have no son, the wife of the dead shall not be married without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn that she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother that is dead, and that his name be not blotted out of Israel. And if the man like not to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate unto the elders and say, My husband's brother refuses to raise up unto his brother a name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother unto me. Then the elders of the city shall call him and speak unto him, and if he stand and say, I like not to take her, then shall his brother's wife come unto him in the presence of the elders and loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face." I'm not making this up, people. I'm reading from the book. I know that sometimes if you're not familiar with the Bible, things like this might surprise you, but I'm reading from the Bible, and I gave you the book, the chapter, and the verse. You can check it out for yourself. "So she shall loose his shoe from off his foot and spit in his face, and she shall answer and say, So shall it be done unto the man that doth not build up his brother's house. And his name shall be called in Israel the house of him that hath his shoe loosed." Sounds a bit discriminatory to me. Here was Onan, who refused to perform this duty, and so God was so displeased with that he killed him. But as if Yahweh said, hey, wait a minute, maybe I was a little bit too drastic in what I did there, he decided that he would reveal this law to the Israelites. And if a man refused to go into his brother's widow and raise up seed to his brother's name, then the worst that was going to happen to him would be that he would be brought before the elders of the village. His brother's widow would loose the shoe off his foot, and spit in his face. If I had my choice of those two punishments, there's no question which one I would take. Now, Mr. Deaver had been trying to tell us that morality is absolute. If morality is absolute, then it doesn't change. What is right today will be right tomorrow, and will be right 10 years from now, and 100 years from now, if morality is absolute. And what is wrong today will be wrong tomorrow, and will be wrong 100 years from now, if morality is absolute. Now, I asked him to tell us last night, if it was a good thing to do when Yahweh killed old man for what he did, he didn't mention it. So I'm going to ask him to tell us tonight, was it a good thing when Yahweh killed old man for this event that we read about in the 38th chapter of Genesis? And was it fair, was it just, to treat Onan in that way and then turn around years later and change the law so that the worst that a man got was to have his shoe loosed and to be spit on in the face? Can you imagine that scene anyway? Here's a guy walking along back then and everybody says, oh, there goes the guy that had his shoe loosed. I'm not making this stuff up, people. It's in the Bible. Now that's nail number one. Let's reach for a couple of others, and they're nails that I've already introduced in the debate. I want to talk more about the massacre of the Midianites and the Amalekites. The circumstances of both of those events have been presented to you. So if you've been here, there's no need for me to summarize them again. You can find them recorded in Numbers, the 31st chapter. Read in particular verses 15 through 18. That has to do with the atrocity that was committed against the Midianites. And in 1 Samuel, the 15th chapter, especially verse 3, you'll read about the atrocity that was committed against the Amalekites. 1 Samuel 15:3 tells us that Yahweh specifically said to Saul that he was to go and utterly destroy the Amalekites for something that their ancestor did 400 years ago. He was to spare no one. He was to kill male and female, infant and suckling, and not just that, but he was also to wipe out their livestock to boot. In Numbers, the 31st chapter, verses 15 through 18, when the Israelite army was coming back with captive women and children, and Moses found out that they hadn't killed everybody, he was angry about it. He went out to meet them, and he said, have you brought back captives? Well, this is what you're to do. You are to kill all of the male children. You are to kill all of the non-virgin women, but you are to take the virgin women children, and you are to keep them alive for yourselves. Now, this was a 400-year grudge. It seemed just a little bit immoral for me for somebody to hold a grudge for that long. If you'll read Deuteronomy, the 25th chapter, verses 17 through 19, you will see that allegedly Moses, if you want to believe that he was the one who wrote this book, I personally don't believe that he did, but I'm sure that Mr. Deaver will. So if you want to believe that Moses was the speaker here, then you'll see that he was telling the people that after they had been settled into the land, that they were to remember what the Amalekites did to them on their migration from Egypt. And then in 1 Samuel, the 15th chapter, they carried that out. My goodness, 21 minutes have passed already. I asked last night if Mr. Deaver wished that these stories were not in the Bible. And he said, why no? Why should I wish that they weren't in the Bible? Well, I'm going to tell you, Mr. Deaver, I do wish that they were not in the Bible. And if they actually happened, I do wish that they had not happened. And I'm not a bit ashamed to stand before you or anyone and say that if they did happen, I wish that they hadn't happened. I wish that the My Lai massacre had not happened in Vietnam, it would have blot against our nation's honor. And I wish that it hadn't happened. And I wish that if the Amalekite massacre took place as recorded in the Bible, I wish that it hadn't happened. Now, Mr. Deaver can't say that. He's talked about the consequences of my position. Well, I want to talk about the consequences of his position. He cannot stand up here and say, I wish that that had not happened. Because the Bible tells us that Yahweh, the God that he believes in so strongly, was the one who commanded that these atrocities should be done. If he says that I wish that it hadn't been done, then he will have to be saying, I wish that God had not done a good thing, because he believes that everything that God does is good. As I said, I'm not going to use the word murder. I'm going to call it deliberate killing. But I want you people to stop thinking in abstract terms. You pick up this book and you read those stories, and it goes in one ear and out the other, I guess. And you don't stop to think in terms of what specifically had to happen if those events happened exactly as they are recorded in the Bible. There were 32,000 young virgin girls that were kept alive in the Midianite captives. And if you read the 35th verse of Numbers, the 31st chapter, you will see that they were divided up among the Israelite soldiers. That means that not just once, but 32,000 times, a young girl was forced to submit to the sexual whims of an Israelite soldier. I wish that hadn't happened. Mr. Deaver, I don't know whether you wish it or not, but I wish that it hadn't happened. If Saul utterly destroyed the Amalekites, as recorded in 1 Samuel, the 15th chapter, except, of course, for King Agag, then you have to imagine that not in just one instance, but in several specific instances, we had a specific Amalekite woman being run through with a sword or a spear wielded by a specific Israelite soldier. Tell us, Mr. Deaver, when that specific Israelite soldier ran through with his sword the specific Amalekite woman and deliberately killed her, was that a good thing to do? Was it? Was that a good thing to do? And when the next specific Israelite soldier took the next specific Amalekite woman and ran her through with the sword, was that a good thing to do, Mr. Deaver? I don't think it was, and I'm not ashamed to say that I don't think it was. How many screaming children in the Amalekite nation do you suppose were standing there seeing what was going on and knowing that it was going to happen to them, experienced the pain of an Israelite sword going through them? Was that a good thing to do, Mr. Deaver? I want you to tell us this. Was that a good thing to do? I'm telling you that I don't think that it was a good thing to do, and if that makes me some kind of monster who deserves to be called an atheist or something like that, then I plead guilty, and I proudly plead guilty to it. I asked him last night, as I mentioned a moment ago, that he probably wishes that these stories were not in the Bible. He said, that's not so. I can't help but think now that he really wishes that those stories were not in the Bible. But he's not going to stand before you and admit it, because he can't. I read to you last night from Deuteronomy, the 7th chapter, verses 1 through 6. And I've got just 3.5 minutes to get this in. But I'd like for you to turn there again. And let's look at it together. When Yahweh thy God shall bring thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, and shall cast out many nations before thee, the Hittite, and the Girgashite, and the Amorite, and the Canaanite, and the Perizzite, and the Hivite, and the Jebusite. The Bible's so interesting to read, isn't it? A seven nations greater and mightier than thou, and when Yahweh thy God shall deliver them up before thee, and thou shalt smite them, then thou shalt utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. What's this? This infinitely benevolent God telling a nation of people, go in and kill everyone and don't show mercy to them? There's something wrong there. He talked about self-contradictions in my position. I'd like for him to explain his way out of this contradiction. How many times does the Bible tell us that God is good, that God is gracious? Here we read that he's telling the Jews to go into the promised land, wipe out everybody, and show them no mercy. He gave some instructions on not being careful not to intermarry with them. And then after that, picking up with verse 5, he said this, but thus shall ye deal with them. Ye shall break down their altars, and dash in pieces their pillars, and hew down their asherim, and burn their graven images with fire, for thou art a holy people unto Yahweh thy God. Yahweh thy God hath chosen thee to be a people for his own possession, above all peoples that are upon the face of the earth. When they went into the promised land, we find that Joshua carried out these instructions according to the Bible. If you will look in the 10th chapter of Joshua, verse 40 tells us that Joshua smote all of the land and that he utterly destroyed all that breathed. He utterly destroyed all that breathed. As Yahweh, the God of Israel, had commanded. And I want you to notice that it said, as Yahweh, the God of Israel, had commanded, he killed everything that breathed. This is repeated in the 11th chapter of Joshua, verses 10 through 11, again in verse 15, again in verses 19 through 20, and I could cite other places. He left nothing alive to breathe. People, that means that there were specific cases where Canaanite women and children were run through with specific swords, yielded by specific Israelite soldiers, presumably under the orders of God. Was that a good thing to do, Mr. Deaver? The floor is yours now. My time is up.